Right now, Wisconsin's history is full of quirky characters and great stories. A new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press introduces us to 80 of them.
In Warriors, Saints, and Scoundrels, brief portraits of real people who shaped Wisconsin, Michael Edmonds and Samantha Snyder bring adventures, politicians, mystics, and more back to life.
Michael Edmonds is Director of Programs and Outreach for the Wisconsin Historical Society. He joins us here in the studio. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, before we meet some of the individuals, what kind of stories were you looking for in this book?
Colorful, short stories, stories about strange people. Most people, when asked, say that history was boring. Well, history's not boring, and we were looking for people who exemplified colorful history.
And one of those, looking to the city of Milwaukee, some people may not know, it has a strong socialist history. I don't know if he qualifies as strange, maybe to today's political taste, but the election of Daniel Hone to mayor. Tell us about him.
That's a great comment. Because he only seems strange in retrospect. He was not strange or very colorful in his time. He grew up poor, and he put himself through college and then law school and got himself elected city attorney in the early years of the 20th century. And those were the days when the corrupt political machines were being challenged at the state level by the progressives. But in Milwaukee, they were being challenged by socialists. And Hone quickly aligned himself with socialism in the city and became an ally of Victor Berger, whom many of your listeners, a name many of your listeners would recognize. In 1916, he managed to get a plurality of votes in a three-way mayoral election and became mayor for a quarter of a century. We think of Milwaukee today not as a very liberal place, but term after term after term, it elected a socialist mayor in the first third of the 20th century.
Of course, there's a bridge named after him there. What else would you say that would be his lasting legacy in Milwaukee?
Well, he was the first mayor to champion things that seem commonplace today, like public housing projects, a public bus system, public trash collection, things that we take for granted today as the normal things any municipality would do, had been under private control, and he was one of the leaders at the turn of the century in putting them under public control instead.
And he made a run for governor, didn't he? He didn't quite make it, though.
He did, toward the end of his life, just before World War II. And of course, as your listeners will remember, after World War II, the state turned very conservative, and people with views like his really had no place at all on the political spectrum. He lived until 1961, but pretty much as a political outcast.
That was one of the biggest names I saw in the book. A lot of the stories you tell are of names we probably haven't heard. And I want to turn to a piece of African-American history in Wisconsin, which people might think back to, you mentioned the book, the civil rights movement in the 60s. It goes way further than that. Voyageurs, the fur trade, there were people of African descent that early. And Stephen Bonga is a story you tell as an example.
Right. You're absolutely right. Ask most people about African-American history in Wisconsin, and all they can think of is the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. But in fact, there were black people living here long before there were any Yankees or Germans or Norwegians living here. And the Bonga family are among the earliest. Stephen Bonga's grandparents came in the 1780s as enslaved people with a British officer. And their son became active in the fur trade and moved across Lake Superior to where Duluth and Superior, Wisconsin are today, where he raised his family. And other fur traders and explorers were just astonished to find living in this Ojibwe village just upriver from Superior a family of African Americans. Stephen Bonga went west with fur traders and guided people through the Lake of the Woods and the Boundary Waters areas. He also went on the Sandy Lake Death March when the U.S. government tried to relocate the Ojibwe across the Mississippi and Minnesota and strand them there. And so he had a very colorful history. And in fact, there are descendants still in Wisconsin today.
And aside from those descendants, are there any other traces of the Bonga family in northern Wisconsin?
That I don't know. I believe there's a lake in Minnesota named after the family, but I don't know about Wisconsin.
And he, again, African-American, he described himself, though, as the first white child born in Wisconsin, I understand, or in that area, because really he was the first non-Native American.
That's
born
right.
There.
That's right. He certainly got the irony involved in the racial politics of it more than 100 years ago.
Right now, we are talking to Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he's sharing some portraits of Wisconsinites that we might not know about. Warrior, Saints, and Scoundrel is the title of his book, and we're learning some of these hidden histories right now. And this is a name I didn't know, but when you talk about colorful stories, wow, Mary Ann McVane. Tell us about her.
She was a lumber camp boss in the 1870s and 80s, north of Green Bay. She moved out here from Maine and settled in the woods, where her husband was nominally the boss of a logging camp. But she was the one with the personality and the character and also the physical size to keep lumberjacks in line. There were very few women in logging camps. In the 1870s, during the early phase of logging, there were some women cooks, but generally the only women around logging camps were nuns who would come out and try to cure the lumberjacks of their evil ways. But she ran camps outside Peshtigo and on the Wolf River with an iron hand. She was very compassionate and charitable and was remembered decades afterwards for her acts of goodwill. But when lumberjacks were unruly or didn't do what they were supposed to, she thought nothing about, as one of the memoir writers said, knocking them cold.
Right. She, like the nuns, was devoted to curing lumberjacks of their evil ways in some cases, with a little more violence than a nun might have.
That's right.
I imagine.
One of the stories in the book is about a lumberjack who, just for fun, tied a rope to one of her chickens and kept throwing it in the river back and forth until it died. And she thought that was not just an abuse of her property, but cruel to the bird. And so she took this giant lumberjack and dragged him into the river and held him under many times in a row until he confessed to having done it and regretted it.
Quite a story there. And you also write about the Paul Bunyan legend in your book. And one person who's associated with that also gave us Wisconsin's mythical creature, the Hodag. What can you tell us about Eugene Shepherd?
Gene Shepherd was a timber cruiser and logging camp foreman all across northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. He even worked in the Pacific Northwest at one point. And everywhere he went, he told stories about a mythical lumber foreman, logging crew foreman of decades past named Paul Bunyan. Minnesotans like to think that Paul Bunyan was invented there, but in fact, that's where the Bunyan tales were popularized by marketers and advertisers. There was an oral tradition in Wisconsin logging camps that dates back to the middle 1880s, and Gene Shepherd is right at the heart of it all. He claimed to have invented Paul Bunyan just west of Rhinelander one winter, but he lied about so many things and plagiarized other people's works that you can't take anything he said for granted.
Well, he may not have invented Paul Bunyan, but speaking of Rhinelander, he did invent or discover
the Hodag.
But invent. The Hodag.
Invent. Lumberjacks had talked about this mythical, ferocious beast, the Hodag, for a generation, and Stewart claimed to have captured one, and so he exhibited it at the Oneida County Fair. It was in dim light, and he made it make noises through ventriloquist's techniques and charged admission to see it. After it was exposed as a hoax, people still came and paid to see it because it had been such a successful hoax.
What were they supposed to have looked like, Hodags?
Somewhere in between a wild boar and an alligator. And they were particularly hungry for novice loggers who hadn't been in the woods long.
Now, you say hoax. I'm looking at your book, and I'm looking at a picture right here. There's an actual picture of guys standing around the Hodag.
That's right, because he was such a great booster and promoter, he had that picture taken and used as postcards to try to lure tourists to the Northwoods.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to close talking about another fellow I didn't know about, and I have to agree with some parts of what he's saying. He's saying, in essence, that Wisconsin is the promised land, is heaven on earth. Tell us about Reverend, what is it, David Van Slyke.
He was an itinerant preacher, a circuit rider, never ordained, who came to Wisconsin before the Civil War and settled in Trempealeau up in northwestern Wisconsin. And after reading the Bible 20 times, he concluded that the biblical Garden of Eden had in fact been located in Wisconsin, right there in Trempealeau, where the Mississippi and other rivers came together. He published a little tract, about 40 pages, about 3 by 5 inches, crudely printed and badly written, which he distributed everywhere he went, claiming that Wisconsin was where the Bible started. Only about, I think, 5 copies of this survived because it was so poorly made, one of which is at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we were delighted to find it and be able to write about him. If you go there today, you'll still see him celebrated in town.
Yeah, and even if his biblical scholarship isn't right on, I think most people can agree, Trempealeau, kind of a paradise in Wisconsin, metaphorically, if not literally.
And certainly has an ancient history. You know, the effigy mounds there mm-hmm. go back 1,000 years, and before them, there's archaeological occupations even older.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That's Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He shared just a few of the many stories in the new book he's co-written with Samantha Snyder. It's called Warriors, Saints, and Scoundrels, Brief Portraits of Real People Who Shaped Wisconsin.